From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Mattie Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
The question everyone is asking is, will this year's El Nino end California's current drought? And regardless, has government done enough to adequately respond to the current drought and prepare for the inevitable next drought? We'll ask. Rachel Ehlers, an expert on water issues with the California Legislative Analyst Office. Elvar Escriva-Bow, an international water policy expert with the Public Policy Institute of California. And Dan Walters, the Sacramento Bee's columnist who covers state politics. El Nino and the drought. Just in time or too little, too late?
We'll also hear from Joe Del Bosque, a farmer on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. Sarge Green, a water management specialist with the California Water Institute at Fresno State. Jason Peltier, head of the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority, a water distributor serving 29 member agencies on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. And Johnny Amaral, the Westlands Water District's Deputy General Manager for External Affairs.
Additional funding for the Mattie Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Mattie Institute, it's the Mattie Report with Executive Director of the Mattie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Everyone knows that California is in a drought, but just how bad is the state's water situation? And will this year's El Nino be enough to declare an end to the state's drought? Our guest is Rachel Ehlers, an expert in water issues with the California Legislative Analyst Office. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So California's been experiencing a pretty serious drought for the past 4 years, but according to some of the stuff that you've written, the drought's actually been going on a lot longer than that, all the way back to 2007, and we had one wet year, 2011, in the middle. So from an historical context, just how bad has this drought been?
You know, it's been pretty bad. The state certainly has had droughts in the past. We have dry cycles and wet cycles. So from that perspective, it's not unusual. But this drought has set some records. The past 4 years have been pretty dry, as you noted. They've actually been the fourth consecutive dry years, the driest four consecutive years on record since the state started measuring in the late 1800s. And it's also been pretty hot. Right. The past 2 years have been the two hottest on record.
And you start seeing some of these maps of as it's kind of expanded across the state. Every year it gets a little worse and worse and worse and worse.
That's right.
You know, we're hearing an awful lot about El Nino. How much have the recent storms actually improved conditions? Can we declare the drought over?
No, I don't think so. The governor declared the drought state of emergency, so I guess he's the one to declare it over, but I don't think anyone is ready to make that kind of declaration. January was pretty wet. That was encouraging, above average rain and snow, but it's kind of trickled off since then. So jury's still out about what 2016 will be, how wet it will be, but at this stage, our reservoirs are well below average across the state. Our groundwater levels are quite depleted, so kind of the hole we're in, it would take quite a bit, and we haven't seen it yet.
The reservoirs really have not increased like we'd like to see them increase. I guess we'll wait and see what the snowpack is and make that determination. Given the research on climate change, are we going to see more frequent and more severe droughts? Is this the new normal?
Well, this is what a lot of the science is suggesting, and a lot of it has to do with those warming temperatures. As I mentioned, the past few years have been really warm. The state traditionally has counted on our snowpack as one of our major sources of water throughout the year as it gradually melts. But with these warmer temperatures, we're getting more rain rather than snow. And then what snow we do get is melting faster.
Right, because it gets warmer. You get some snow and it gets warmer. And
the soils are drier, so it's absorbing into the soils. The plants are soaking up more. All of that decreases the runoff. And demand is also higher for water when it's warmer, both in agricultural and urban settings. So I think there are some concerning signs that this could be a sign of what's to come.
The new normal. Can you explain? I mean, people live in different parts of the state. Sometimes they're kind of isolated. They don't really understand what's happening in other parts of the state. So what has the impact been on the drought on like the ag industry in the Central Valley or on water quality in some of the small rural communities or on the environment or even in urban areas?
Yeah, it really has varied across different areas of the state. The agricultural sector, as you mentioned, is typically really dependent on a lot of those surface water deliveries that start up in the mountains and come down to them through.
They say that the water's north, but the demand is south.
That's right. The demand is middle and south. That's right. That's right. And so the agricultural sector has had to fallow farm fields, purchase water for pretty high rates. But really, one of the main strategies upon which they've relied is groundwater pumping, which has been a great strategy, but kind of isn't sustainable for the long term. And really, we've seen some concerning signs about some of the impacts of that groundwater pumping, including land subsidence, land sinking.
Land is actually sinking. So just quickly, the implications of that are the land is sinking, then roads sink, canal sink.
That's right.
Train track sink,
that's
houses
right.
and
bridges. Yes,
bridges, yeah.
Right. And the underground geology is somewhat that it can't come back.
Right. I mean, I remember talking to someone from the Geological Service a while ago, and they were saying that, you know, once you take the water out, those rocks with the aquifer, what, they collapse.
The clay, that's right.
And then you don't have that space anymore.
That's right. So there's concerns about how that can continue. In urban areas where residents live, the primary experience has been really to have to cut back on water use. The state passed a requirement to reduce water use by 25% compared to 2013. So there have also been mandatory restrictions on outdoor watering, but also a lot of encouragement to take shorter showers along with that. But then, as you mentioned, some of the more rural communities, the impacts have been pretty severe. From, in some cases, domestic wells going dry, so really losing water. And similarly, the impacts to the environment have been very concerning. Some of our endangered species, rivers and streams getting warmer or drying up completely, forests drying, trees dying.
I was reading in your report about the trees. It's an amazing number. U.S. Forest Service says 29 million trees have died.
Right, and that's several months old at this point. So
it's more than that.
And that has led to some of the really intense and severe wildfires that we've seen as well in recent years.
So it's all a system. One impacts the other, obviously.
Right.
Well, thank you for that summary of California's current drought. Up next, what is the federal, state, and local government response to the drought? And has it been enough? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome. We're talking with Rachel Ehlers, an expert on water issues with the California Legislative Analyst Office, about the government's response to the drought. So let's talk about the federal government. What have they done to respond to the drought?
Well, they've provided some funding. Estimates are around $500 million has come to the state from the federal government over the past couple years and really have coordinated very closely with state government, state agencies, in a lot of their response. But really, they've been kind of deferring to the state to take the lead.
Okay. Let's talk about we're going to get to the state in a second. Let's talk about local governments, though, for a moment. How have they responded to the drought?
Yeah, most of the local government response has been around this state requirement to reduce water usage by 25%.
And they did hit the target initially. It was like 25.5%. I don't know if they're still doing that well, but initially they seem to be hitting the target.
Yeah, I mean, it was a multi-month target.
Sometimes good, sometimes not.
And it
so
was
good.
Everybody knew that the reductions would be bigger in the warmer months because that's when we use most of our water outside for outdoor watering and that it would decrease in the winter. So I think we're getting close to that 25%. We'll see.
I want to say about half of the urban use is outdoor watering.
I think it's even more than half.
It's quite a bit.
So that's really one of the areas that the state has targeted and that local governments targeted as well.
And that's where we're seeing a lot of people, at least in my neighborhood, they're taking out their lawns.
That's right. And some of these local governments actually even use local funding to help encourage and incentivize some of that, giving grants for folks to take out their lawns and replace appliances, that sort of thing.
Okay. Now, you talk about the state's response as being multifaceted. Explain.
Yeah, it's been very widespread. The state has provided about $3 billion over the past several years for drought response activities across 13 different state departments and agencies.
It's multi.
And the activities have really varied in nature. Some have been really emergency response, both for humans living in drought-affected
water quality
communities,
issues and
bringing drinking water and drinking water tanks to areas where domestic wells have gone dry, but also job assistance and housing assistance.
Now, a lot of that is in the San Joaquin Valley.
That's right. That's where some of the impacts have been felt the most. There's also been kind of emergency, urgent response for environmental impacts of the drought, in some cases even trucking fish from streams to fish hatcheries where special chillers have been installed to help them survive, and then obviously very big fire response as well. But the state's also invested in water conservation activities, increasing efficiency at state buildings and farm fields, and then also really undertaken some widespread, long-term, bigger infrastructure projects that probably won't really affect this drought, but could help in the future. Things like water recycling, wastewater treatment grants, primarily funded with Proposition 1, which is the water bond, voters passed in 2014. So it really has been a kind of a multifaceted, widespread response.
They've also actually reduced their water delivery, some of the state water project.
That's right.
As well, and that's been a big drop-off, and I think farmers are concerned about that. What about the governor's drought response in his current budget?
Yeah, so he's got 23 $323 million in the proposal for the upcoming year, and about two-thirds of that would continue a lot of these urgent emergency kind of responses, both for humans and for the environment and for fires, really, in those kind of three categories. But about $90 million of that proposal is for some new water and energy efficiency programs that would be funded through the state's greenhouse gas reduction program.
And those have long-term implications because they continue to conserve water in years in the future.
That's right.
I don't think anybody's expecting that droughts aren't going to happen in California's future. I think people are saying it's more likely they are going to happen,
maybe even
more frequently.
That's right. And I think that's part of the state's response has been throughout this is both short-term and thinking more longer-term.
So I'm just wondering, what is the LAO's assessment of the governor's budget proposals on the drought?
Yeah. So given the indications that this drought, at least the impacts will continue at least to some degree in the coming year, we think it makes sense to prepare for that, particularly those urgent emergency responses. For some of the water and energy efficiency proposals, we think there needs to be a little bit more information that the legislature will need to evaluate those and see if that's the most effective use of those funds. But preparing for a continued drought, we think at this point makes sense.
So when you're talking about legislature needs to take a closer look at things, you're talking about the cap and trade funds and how they're being used to deal with water issues.
That's right.
Is that the issue? And your concern there is what, maybe not the most efficient?
Well, I think we just need some more information. What are the expected outcomes of these programs? It's really that nexus between water efficiency, but also energy efficiency, using less energy.
So that kind of gets us to the LAO's recommendations. So you've got a few drought-related recommendations. What are they?
We are recommending that the legislature approve the governor's emergency urgent response proposals, preparing for continued drought. We're kind of holding off on those cap and trade funded proposals until we get some more information to find out if that's the most effective use of the funds. But we're also recommending the legislature not lose this opportunity to prepare for future droughts. As you mentioned, I think we know throughout history droughts reoccur, but given the suggestion that droughts maybe continue to be intense in the future, what have we learned from our response to this drought? What additional policy changes could we put in place now to help facilitate responses in the future? What didn't go so well during this drought that we can kind of prepare for? So I think we just want to be sure that we don't lose this opportunity, even while we're still in the midst of some crisis.
Yeah, you're looking at the long term
and
preparing for that, so the next drought maybe won't be as severe in terms of implications on the population.
Yeah, at least we're better prepared to handle it.
Great. Well, thank you. Rachel Ehlers with the Legislative Analyst Office for that summary of federal, state, and local response to the current drought. Up next, when it comes to water storage, will we ever catch up, or is it just too little too late at this point? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. Our next guest is Alvar Escriva-Bow, a research fellow with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, their Water Policy Center, and an international expert on water issues. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having me here.
Well, let's talk about the implications of rain as opposed to snowpack. What's the difference there?
We're seeing that we're having more rain and less snow lately. This is because temperatures are increasing. So what...
That climate change people are talking about. Perhaps. Okay.
There are some kind of different implications for California. What we will see is that we will have more water when we less need it. It's in the winter. Mm-hmm. And we have less water when we actually use it. That it's in the summer. So we'll have to manage to differently the way that we manage right now our reservoirs. So
because we counted on the snowpack before, right? That's not going to be the situation going forward. You know, there's this discussion about water storage, and there's discussion about above ground or below ground. So, you know, a below ground would be like water banking. You pump the water into the ground. The above ground would be dams or reservoirs. I'm just wondering, which is more cost-effective way to store water?
I think that we don't have to go into rivalries between one or the other, but we have to assess both cases in a serious way. Like, we have all these costs. Dams are expensive. Dams have environmental costs. So pumping groundwater from the ground, it's also expensive. But
yeah, remember that cost, right? You have to pump it out of the ground in and out.
It looks like we have developed a lot. We have more than 1,400 surface reservoirs in California, so mm-hmm. that's a lot. We have few places to build a cost-effective dam right now. But even though we have to assess both things, we have to assess costs and also benefits. And when we talk about benefits, it's not the benefits of this last drought that it has been really damaging. It's long-term benefits. Mm-hmm. Even the years that we have a lot of water, we don't have many costs. So these long-term benefits have to be assessed and compared with the costs that we have.
You know, there's been a lot of, you know, because of the drought, a lot of groundwater pumping. I'm just wondering, you know, what are the implications of groundwater pumping during the drought?
Yeah, it has helped a lot. We have offset most of our surface shortage in many places in California. And we have to say as well that not every basin is overdrafted. Not every basin is in a critical situation. There's many places in California where we have been pumping groundwater in a kind of sustainable way, but there are some regions where we have problems, mostly in the Tulare Basin, in the Salinas.
The San Joaquin Valley has got some issues. Yeah.
Salinas, some issues also in Salinas. So in these places, we have to try. There have been many problems. We have two big problems. The first one is that shallow wells went dry, and this is an economical problem for farmers, but it's a socioeconomic problem also for rural communities that more than 3,000 domestic wells went dry last year.
They go dry. There's no water there. So then water's got to be trucked in or whatever.
And the second implication is like land subsidence. We are having this land sinking, and we are having a lot of economic costs for large infrastructure, roads, buildings, and others. And
so, the water is in between the clay or rock or whatever, and then when the water goes away, that collapses, and then the whole ground collapses, and then roads, canals, buildings.
It's millions of costs in potential millions of costs in that.
I'm thinking probably
problem.
Billions it might even be, depending on how bad it is.
Yes,
so there's been some state legislation to kind of address this issue, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. And regions are supposed to adopt and start implementing plans to manage groundwater beginning in 2020. I'm just wondering, is it too little, too late?
It's the first time that the state is regulating groundwater. So that's a first. That's a big step ahead. So that's the first point. And the second is that not every basin, it's overdrafted. We have some problems, and these basins that are overdrafted have to start moving quickly. The way that they are implementing this plan is to be managed by locals. Right. So there's a lot of, communities have to be created. They have to develop their plans. So we need some time for that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's. We have seen as well that they are already working on that. These communities that are really damaged, that they are starting to work with this because it's for their own benefit.
So it's going to take some time.
Yeah,
obviously.
It's going to take.
Well, I want to thank our guest, Alvar Escriva-Bo with the PPIC's Water Policy Center. Up next, the politics of water with the Sacramento Bee's Dan Walters. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. When someone wants to get an insight on the politics of important state issues like water, Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee is usually the go-to source. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Thank you, Mark.
So before we start talking about water politics at the state capitol, I want to ask you about water politics in Washington. Senator Feinstein has tried yet again to broker a deal for water at the federal level. Any chance of that happening this time?
I think unless you have a consensus within California, you're not going to get something through Congress. The rest of Congress, the rest of the Senate, the rest of the House is going to look at things and say, have you got all your stuff together in California? Or is this something you're trying to shove down somebody's throat in California? And until you have that kind of consensus, I don't think it's going to happen in Washington. And you also have the situation that in pairing with John Garamendi, Garamendi's very, very, very much opposed to peripheral canals, to the tunnels.
And going back a few years.
That becomes a complicating factor. I mean, how can you avoid that issue if you're doing a water bill? And that becomes a kind of a roadblock as well.
Well, let's talk about those twin tunnels. You see different numbers. $15 billion is probably an appropriate number as any for that project, this twin tunnels project the governor is pushing for the Delta. Currently, though, there's an initiative being pushed by a wealthy Stockton area farmer and food processor, which would require voter approval before the state could issue revenue bonds for any project of more than $2 billion.
Yes.
Could that sink the Twin Tunnels project?
It probably would sink the Twin Tunnels project because it's unlikely that you could get approval for those bonds on a statewide basis.
Isn't that the whole point of using revenue bonds, so you don't have to get the voter approval?
Yes, it is one of the points of using revenue bonds. Also, you don't tap the taxpayers to repay the bonds. That's the ostensible reason for it. However, there are a couple of factors. Number one, the use of revenue bonds has kind of been twisted in recent years, and a lot of revenue bonds aren't really revenue bonds. For example, we build prisons with revenue bonds, and the only source of revenue for those revenue bonds is the lease payments paid by the state. So the state pays the state, and under the subterfuge of using revenue bonds because they want to avoid public votes. Mm-hmm. And the governor and the other advocates of the tunnels do not want a public vote on those tunnels because they know probably they would lose. So the idea is to do it without a vote, and this would essentially require a vote. However, that's not the beginning and the end of the troubles for these tunnels. The reluctance of the major water agencies in the San Joaquin Valley and the Southern California seems to be growing. They're becoming weary of this.
Because they would be paying for this under normal circumstances.
They would be paying for it, and they're starting to see, what are we getting for our money? Mm-hmm. And it's particularly true, interesting, one of the interesting things coming out of the drought is in Southern California is becoming less and less dependent on Northern California water. They have figured it out.
More conservation.
Conservation, desalination, mm-hmm. More storage, wastewater recycling, mm-hmm. and so forth. And at, the more they become independent, the less they are needing those tunnels to give them water reliability. And then the farmers down in the Westlands Water District are getting a little upset with the idea that we're going to cost them a lot of money. They're already strapped because of the money they've had to pay for water to get through the drought, and they're feeling the financial pinch, and they're becoming very reluctant to put up more money for these things.
Let me ask you about another thing that's being circulated for the November ballot, and that is this proposal that would divert money from the 2008 California High-Speed Rail bond and the 2014 water bond into a new water authority. Surprisingly, there are quite a few powerful ag and water groups that are voicing opposition to this. Why?
Well, they worked out a deal on the water bond that was passed by the voters a couple of years ago, and they don't want to upset that apple cart. They've got something finally after years of trying, and they don't want to take a chance that it might be upset if you introduce this new element of the bullet train bonds into the equation. On the other hand, if that thing makes the ballot, it's going to have a lot of momentum behind it. The people don't like the bullet train. The bullet train has lost favor with the voters of California. And if they would look at it...
It's about a 50-50 split.
Yeah, they would look at it as a chance to kill the bullet train, as opposed to...
They're saying that's not the reason.
Oh, of course not. But that's really what's going on here. And it's the sort of thing, yeah, I can understand why the farmers wouldn't like it, but on the other hand, I could see that thing passing. I really could see that thing passing.
You know, one thing you mentioned in an article you wrote recently is that the state's water needs are kind of, there's a conflict as to whether we should be just saying, listen, deal with a limited water supply, start conserving, or increase the water supply. That seems to be the conflict. So, you know, politics is all about the art of compromise. Mm-hmm. So where's the sweet spot on that issue?
Well, presumably there is a sweet spot, but they haven't found it yet. When you start talking about water, the most important thing to remember is the fighting over water in California is not over water. The fighting over water in California is over land use, because the land use is dependent on water, whether it's agricultural land or whether it's urban land, it's dependent on water supply. So when all of these conflicts over water are surrogates for conflicts over how California is going to develop or not develop land. And you get into this issue of supply versus conservation, that's where that land use thing really hits, because new uses for land require new sources of water. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have those new sources of water, you can't develop the land. And a lot of environmental groups don't want to develop a land, ergo they don't want to have new sources of water. Mm-hmm. And they beat the conservation drum very, very strongly. Probably we ought to be talking about not necessarily new supply versus conservation, but we ought to probably be talking about reallocating the supply that we have already and start looking at things like water rights. I know that just kills some farmers. Water rights and that sort of thing to rationalize the use of water rather than trying to build something on what is kind of an irrational basis.
You just open up a whole new Pandora's box.
It's the next thing. After groundwater regulation, the next frontier of water in California will be water rights.
And I'm sure we'll be addressing that. I want to thank Dan Walters from Sacramento Bee for joining us. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can check us out on Twitter or Facebook, or take a look at our website for the Maddie Daily, our free e-newsletter on state politics. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
Up next, we'll talk to Joe Del Bosque, a farmer on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, Sarge Green with the California Water Institute at Fresno State, Jelson Peltier with the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority, and Johnny Amaral with the Westlands Water District.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
Welcome back. Perhaps nowhere in the state has been more impacted by the current drought than the San Joaquin Valley. What is the prognosis for the valley? Is less water the new normal? What impact will it have on the valley's leading industry, agriculture? We've got several guests to discuss this and more. Johnny Amaral is Westlands Water District's Deputy General Manager for External Affairs. Welcome, Johnny.
Thank you, Mark.
Jason Peltier is the head of the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority. Welcome, Jason.
Yes, sir. Hello.
And Sarge Green is with the California Water Institute at Fresno State.
Good afternoon.
And Joe Del Bosque is a Westside farmer. Welcome, Joe.
Hello, Mark.
So, Johnny Amaral with Westlands, let me start with you first. What are your thoughts on the current El Nino? Has it solved our water problems, at least for the short term?
Well, it has the potential to solve our water problems. And most people in the state think that with all the snowpack in the Sierras and the massive amount of water causing, in some cases, property damage and flooding through all over the state of California, that, you know, we're well on our way to solving our state's water crisis. The problem we have is that the way this water is being managed by the federal agencies, it defies common sense and defies logic. There's a massive amount of waste of fresh water going out to the ocean for the purposes of Delta smelt, and we can never climb out of the hole that's been dug over the last 3 years if we're not maximizing water supply deliveries when it's coming down the Sierras and into the Delta.
So Jason, is the climate cooperating but the government not cooperating on this issue?
Oh, that's it, exactly. We're, you know, rain-wise in Northern California, we're in great shape. We're 12 inches ahead of where we were last year, and last year wasn't that bad. Shasta is approaching normal storage amount. We've got flood control operations on the American River with huge amounts being dumped down the out of Folsom, and the projection is we're going to see the Yellow Bypass just west of Sacramento start to flow in a couple days. So yeah, we're awash in water in terms of and you know, we've recovered real well. Now, it'll take a while to recover from the effects of the drought, but hydrologically speaking, we're in great shape. Yet we anticipate a zero allocation for a bunch of our members, the water service contractors like Westlands and other folks on up towards Tracy, to start the year. Even though, and we could end up in a really weird situation where a lot of CVP contractors are at 0 or 10% or, you know, hopefully maybe 20%. I mean, it's a pretty bizarre statement to make, and given how wet everything is, but I mean, that's how desperate we are and how reconciled we are to dealing with the realities of the regulatory drought. We're going to face that. A lot of our members will face that. Well, I would anticipate the state project is going to be at 40 or 50% of allocation when all things are said and done here. So there's a real breakdown in the CVP. It's definitely a broken project, and it's all a function of the fish regulations, which sadly have done no good for the fish.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Sarge Green, you're an expert with the Water Policy Institute at Fresno State. You know, the stuff I've been reading is people think this is a four-year drought. It's actually been a lot longer than that. You know, it's actually more like a nine-year drought with one wet year in between. So this has been going on for a while. And I'm just wondering, you know, you're hearing a lot about climate change and the impact that may be having on the issue. I'm just wondering, is climate change kind of creating the new normal where we're going to see maybe more rain, less snowfall, maybe longer droughts? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a possibility. More rain means earlier runoff in many instances, and as pointed out by the other gentleman, one of the problems we have is we have to capture it when they have the opportunity. If it rains too much and we don't have it stored in the snowpack, snowpack is the second largest storage system in California, about 14 million acre feet on an average year. I know there's no such thing as an average year, but nonetheless.
So basically what you're saying is snow is almost like a bank of water. water, right? It's sitting there. It's not going anywhere until it starts to get warmer.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so if you have more rain, it's difficult to capture. It's difficult to redistribute quickly enough, because one of the after effects of this long drought has the groundwater has declined tremendously. And one El Nino year will not make a dent in that.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Joe, as a farmer on the west side, what are your concerns here in terms of climate change? Are you concerned at all that it's going to change how much water you're going to get because of lack of snow or maybe more coming of rain and not being captured? What are your concerns along those lines?
Our biggest concern is if we're going to catch the opportunities. And if we're going to have rain rather than snow, that means there's going to be runoff opportunities, which we've seen our operators miss out on. And that's our big concern, because we've seen this happen in the past. It's deja vu. We saw this happen in 2012, where something like 400,000 acre feet was lost. There was a heavy rainfall.
Can you put that in for people who don't know what that means, 400,000 acre feet? Could you put that in some kind of perspective that the listener could understand?
Yeah, 400,000 acre feet would farm close to 200,000 acres, which is a vast amount of acreage. It would produce a vast amount of food and create jobs. So it is a lot. And, you know, to put it into context, I think we've got somewhere on 500,000 acres fallow right now going into this year, and it could be more. So it would bring a lot of that back into production. Okay. But if we're not, you know, opportunistic about those early flows, as Sarge said, when the rivers are flowing quickly out to the ocean, then we're not going to be able to weather the dry years.
Yeah, Johnny, I'm going to follow up on that. You know, you hear a lot about capturing water and storage, and whether it should be above ground in dams or below ground in water banking. And I'm just wondering, you know, what is the most cost-effective way to store water, number one? And number two, what has the greatest potential for storage capacity? Is there more room underground, or is it if we build Temperance Flat or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, what's being discussed now is, you know, we have this huge series of dams on the east side of the valley and northern California that capture water. It's the most efficient way to harness the resource as you get it. When it's snowpack, snowpack turns into runoff, and it captures naturally into these dams. It's you know, the challenge here when you talk about cost effectiveness is, you know, billions of dollars of infrastructure that has been invested and spent over the course of the last several decades to build this these projects as we know them, that's just being wasted. It's infrastructure that's not being utilized. It's dams and storage facilities that aren't being pumped into because of these biological opinions. And so the first thing I would like to see is for us to be able to stop the bleeding. The bleeding is this colossal waste of water that takes place every time we have rain events and runoff that comes into the Delta. And so to talk about storage, it would be great if we could actually talk about utilizing what we currently have, because it's really an engineering feat. It's really quite amazing to see how all these projects were built and how they work together, how it works to supply this state. I mean, we need to stop the bleeding, stop the waste of the water in the state before we can talk about expanding.
And so, Jason, you're with the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority. And what are your thoughts on this in terms of above ground storage with dams and below ground, you know, groundwater banking? Is one better than the other, or should both be done?
I'm definitely an all of the above kind of guy. I think the groundwater storage has great attributes. It also has drawbacks. It's slow to put water in. It's slow to get water out. Surface storage can respond much better to runoff. But, you know, the bigger point is really with the Endangered Species Act regulations that are been laid on both the CVP and the State Water Project, the reality is that water for human use has really been, its availability has really been disconnected from the hydrology. So we could have a wet year, we could have water in storage, but we can't move it across the Delta and get it to where there's a huge demand. I mean, if you look at this year alone, good, nice wet year so far, and we've lost 650,000 acre feet of water to the ocean that we otherwise would have pumped. similar to the number Joe cited for an earlier year. If you compare delta outflow and the amount of water that's moved south out of the delta, last year we only had a couple of storms. It was a weak year. We had a weak snowpack. It was definitely a hydrologic drought. We saw at this same time last year about 1.3 million acre feet of water had flowed to the ocean as delta outflow, and we would have been able to export 650,000. This year, a much wetter year, we've seen 2.8 million acre feet of water go to the ocean, and we've exported even less, 627,000 acre feet. So it's the system is broken, and we're disconnected from kind of the realities the system was built upon.
You know, if you read some of the reports, I've tried to, and I'm not a water expert by any stretch, but you take a look at what the Public Policy Institute of California has written or the Legislative Analyst Office, you know, Sarge, they're saying that above ground storage, you can hold basically 42 million acre feet of water, but below ground storage has the capacity of 120 million acre feet of water, so three times as much. But still, there's a discussion here about whether or not below ground is truly really the best way to go. And one of the issues is it's maybe a little more costly to pump it into the ground. It's got to use energy to pump it into the ground as opposed to a dam, use gravity, frankly, to move the water. I mean, what are your thoughts on all that, this issue between, you know, underground groundwater banking or above ground dams? And I know you've used the term conjunctive use, so I'm going to let you use that term and go ahead and define it as well.
Okay. Conjunctive use is the combination of using surface water and underground water. And a great example is the Fryant Division of the Central Valley Project, where the east side growers in the San Joaquin Valley, when they have wet years, do over-apply on the irrigated land. And then when the supply dries up, they convert over to their wells. So any year that the wells are not turned on, the groundwater is improving considerably. Unfortunately, much as these gentlemen have pointed out, the Fryant Division is also connected to the Delta because it's an exchange. The water that comes out of the San Joaquin River historically went to the area known as the exchange contractors in Los Banos and portions of western Fresno County, southern Merced, all the way up to Stanislaus County. And their exchange was they get water out of the Delta, and that freed up water for the east side. Well, because of the problems in the Delta, once again, they have had to go back onto the San Joaquin River, and that foregoes the opportunity for east side districts to take the Fryant water and put it on the ground. Now, having said that, one of the other limitations, I agree with Jason, it's never a single action. It's all of the above. And one of the things that we have a problem with is connectivity. And that is not only do you need the storage system above ground, the ability to get it into the ground, but the delivery facilities. And we're not connected that well. So I think that's one of the other things that people are probably going to ask of us is how do you work this in a systems approach, and what investments are you willing to make so that we can justify moving water from Northern California into your area? It may not take a whole lot of money. It may take quite a bit of money. That piece of the pie has not been completely determined yet. So I think we've got some work to do.
You know, Joe, I want to ask you to follow up on this whole groundwater discussion we're having, and that is, you know, a lot of pumping of groundwater during the drought. They have to rely on that because they're not getting water elsewhere. The number's quite high. I think I read 60% sometimes during a drought of the water is coming from groundwater. So I want to get your thoughts on these local plans that are supposed to be developed to better manage groundwater resources. Supposed to have these plans, start working on these plans by 2020. Too little, too late? Do we need to reduce our reliance on groundwater pumping even sooner?
Well, we probably should have started sooner, but it's never too late. Groundwater depletion is affecting some areas worse than others. But we also have to have a plan on how to replenish some of that lost water, because we're going to be looking at the depletion of water and trying to maintain a reasonable level of groundwater. But that means that you're not just watching what water comes out. You also have to be aware of what water goes back in to replenish it. And that's all got to be part of the plan.
Johnny, I'm just wondering what Westlands thinks about these local groundwater management plans and whether or not it's going to make groundwater a sustainable resource going forward.
Well, we've been very involved for a long time in Weston's Water District, unlike many other districts, and we know exactly what gets extracted from the groundwater, from the aquifer. All of our wells have meters on them, so we know what comes out. Clearly, what's happening with the groundwater is not a sustainable action. I mean, you can't keep extracting water from the ground at the rate that it's being extracted without having long-term serious effects on a whole host of things.
And they talk about subsidence where the ground is actually sinking.
Right. But the missing link, of course, is, you know, there is a direct correlation between what's happening with the groundwater and subsidence. There's a direct correlation between that and the lack of surface supplies or the curtailment of surface supplies. Farmers would much rather irrigate with surface water. There's costs associated with extracting water from the ground to lift the water out of the ground. It's a different water quality, has different effects on different crops. You have to have a solution that includes a reliable surface supply of water when there's going to be regulations on how much water gets extracted.
That's interesting because that's also, frankly, an environmental issue. Environmental issue in terms of the groundwater and maintaining the groundwater, the purity, and also subsidence. So it's not just – it's a question of not just the fish and the delta, but it's also a question of the environment when it comes to groundwater. So those things are kind of interrelated, it seems. Well, I want to thank you for that conversation, but up next we're going to talk about the politics of water. That should be interesting. Up next, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking with Johnny Amaral, the Westlands Water District Deputy General Manager for External Affairs, Jason Peltier, the head of the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority, Sarge Green with the California Water Institute at Fresno State, and Joe Del Bosque, a Westside farmer. So, Johnny Amaral with Westlands, I want to ask you this. You know, Senator Feinstein has tried yet again to broker a deal on water at the federal level. Do you think it's going to finally happen this time? And if not, why not?
Well, I gave up making predictions on what will happen in Washington a long time ago. You would think
that. Didn't you used to work there?
I did, yeah. But I still don't make predictions because it's very unpredictable.
You've learned by living there, right?
But you would think, given the dire situation, not just felt by those of us in the Central Valley, but the entire state of California, that there would be a sense of urgency to get something enacted into law in Washington. I mean, the good news is that virtually no one in Washington disagrees that there is a need for legislation. 5 years ago, there was disagreement about whether or not there was a need for legislation to fix these problems. Everyone agrees that there's a need for legislation to fix these problems. What that legislation looks like, too early to know.
Congressman Valadao has put forward a proposal as well. I mean, won't they reconcile those two, the Senate bill and the House bill, to come up with a solution?
The plan, as I understand it going forward, is that the House of Representatives has moved their bill. They moved it last summer. Senator Feinstein introduced her bill just about a month ago or so. And the House of Representatives, their plan is to wait or to try to help Senator Feinstein move her bill out of the U.S. Senate so that there can be either an official or unofficial conference or a negotiation to hammer out the differences between the two bills. Eventually, that's where it's got to get. But it has to move out of the Senate first before there can be any type of discussion about a conference or a compromise.
Right. So Sarge Green with the Water Institute, what are your thoughts on Senator Feinstein's attempt here? Is it eventually going to pass the Senate so we have this reconciliation attempt between the House and the Senate to get a water bill out?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen this year. I think what has to happen is the senator has to convince everybody that it's in everybody's best interest to move California water issues forward, because it's just a harbinger of what's going to happen in other areas. Let me be a little more specific. Right now, interestingly enough, there's two cases before the Supreme Court, Mississippi versus Tennessee over groundwater, and Georgia versus Florida, or Florida versus Georgia, over surface water.
It sounds like a football game.
So everybody has an interest and or issues with water. And so it has to rise to a certain level. And clearly California has not been able to get to that level with everybody else, but I think it's going to happen.
Well, you know what, I'm going to ask Jason to kind of flip gears a little bit and talk about the governor's $15 billion plus twin tunnels project called the California Water Fix, where he's trying to address the Delta issues to get water to Central and Southern California. There's currently an initiative being pushed by a Stockton area farmer that would require voter approval before the state could issue revenue bonds, not general obligation bonds, but revenue bonds for any project costing more than $2 billion. And some people are thinking that could spell the doom for the governor's Twin Tunnels project. What do you think, Jason?
First, just a second on the federal legislation.
Sure.
I think it's sad is not a strong enough word that we can't see Congress act in a time of crisis like we've been living through in the drought. But it's even more so with that backdrop, it's even harder to imagine that Congress would actually deal with the regulatory drought, the drought that's taken a whole bunch of our members from 90% reliability to 40% reliability. That's the monster that needs to be dealt with. And there's, given the track record here in the real crisis, in the crisis of the moment, of the hydrologic drought, it's hard to hold hope for the you know, our elected officials being able to actually deal with a man-made problem. A problem of our own making, a problem of our own laws and implementation of those laws.
Well, let's talk about a possible solution, the governor's Twin Tunnels project. I mean, are you concerned at all with this proposal to take revenue bonds and say anything costing more than $2 billion has got to be approved by the voters, which traditionally that's not the case?
Yeah, of course I'm concerned. I think the scope and the reach of and the damage that initiative could cause to not just water, but all kinds of infrastructure problems in our state, and we've got lots of them. And every sector you look at is pretty pretty frightening. On the tunnels themselves, I think that we have arrived at a place where we have a well-engineered solution to transferring water across the Delta. We have, however, a project that is not viable from a business perspective. The economics don't work. The water is too expensive. I mean, the simple notion that we're gonna pay collectively some $15 billion and get the same amount or less water. I mean, there's no business sense in that. So, well designed, it's been smothered, literally by overly conservative, overly protective fish regulators who just say we want more water for the fish. Even though we have 20 years of history of that exact approach to regulation not doing a thing to help the fish or any ecosystem indicators.
Well, let me ask Joe Del Bosque, who's a farmer, Westside farmer. Are you at all concerned about this attempt by another farmer up in Stockton to say, you know, the state should get voter approval before they do any project worth more than $2 billion in terms of a revenue bond project? Does that concern you?
Sure it does, because that could put a stop to a lot of other projects. So it's very far-reaching. I mean, that could probably stop, say, like L.A. if they wanted to build more storage of their own down there.
And then the question also is Temperance Flat, too? I mean, what is the cost of Temperance Flat to build that? I'm guessing it's more than $2 billion. It's $4 billion, Johnny's telling me. So would that have to get voter approval as well, or is that already covered by the water bond? So who knows? That could cause all kinds of problems. Let's transition to another thing, though. Sarge, I want to ask you this question, and I want to ask Johnny as well. And there's another proposal on the ballot, potentially on the ballot in November, that would divert money from California's 2008 high-speed rail bond and the 2014 water bond into this new water authority. What are your thoughts on that proposal?
Well, I don't think the priority is misplaced. I laud the idea of making sure that water stays high priority. But much like the other initiative, I think it would establish a precedent of reallocating bond money that I don't think anybody really wants to go there. I think it would be a problem if we had a future water bond and all of a sudden somebody else came along and said, no, we don't want to spend that on water this time. We want to move that money someplace else. So from the precedent standpoint, I think it has a real problem.
You know, it's interesting. You're reading the newspaper, but Manuel Cunha from the Nisei Farmers League, at least surprisingly, came out and said you would think that he wants more money for water projects, but he came out actually against this proposal. So Johnny Amaral with Westlands, what is your thought about this idea of taking high-speed rail money and the existing water bond money and putting into one new kind of super agency?
Well, if I can for a moment remove my Westlands Water District hat and wear my private citizen hat right now. I happen to think I differ a little bit with Sarge on this, because we spend most of our time here in the Central Valley on our heels, constantly on a defensive posture, defending who we are, defending what we do, defending what we grow. We grow the most nutritious, most valuable crops in the world. We spend all of our time on our heels defending ourselves. I see this initiative as an opportunity to be on offense, to finally have the people of the state answer the question that we'd like for them to answer about priorities, infrastructure priorities, what's more important. And I can understand all sides of the argument, but I see it as an opportunity for this area and, in fact, the state at this thing. I haven't seen the polling, but I'm sure it pulls off the charts. I just see it as an opportunity to really be on offense and shine a light on the need, the real infrastructure needs in this state, which are water.
You know, could this be maybe the perfect being the enemy of the good, in the sense that if you were successful, it gets on the ballot and you're correct, let's say it passes, isn't that just going to invite litigation and more delays? And so win the battle, lose the war?
Well, we're used to litigation in this state, especially if you're in water. I mean, it's part of the cost of doing business. And to be quite candid, that'd be great. If we get to the point where we're arguing for these priorities in the public domain and amongst the public, that's where we want to be. Instead of constantly just trying to frantically defend ourselves, being on offense and making these arguments, I think that's a good thing for the state and especially for the Valley.
So I guess we're going to see. Well, I want to thank our guest, Johnny Amaral with the Westlands Water District, Jason Pelletier with the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority, Sarge Green with the California Water Institute at Fresno State, and Joe Del Bosque, a Westside farmer. Thanks all of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.